Welcome everybody to introduction to our yoga day. My name is Anuradha Duni. Anyway, we've invited you here. The point is to try and give a taster, broad brushstrokes, an overview of all that is yoga, because it's probably one of the most well-used words today to do with Hindu traditions and ideas. But so nuanced in its understanding, it can mean a vast range of different things. So hopefully today we'll sketch some of what it means from a historical perspective, from the particularity of the go-to text, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, which everybody knows about and has heard as the definitive text on yoga philosophy, which the dense maybe not know so much about. And then what's more well known in the world today is Hatha Yoga and the practice of the bodily exercise, the asanas. And then how do they all fit together when sometimes they seem to be so different, while there's a common thread present in all of them? Before I start, I'd just like a hand show of how many people here do practice yoga. Hatha Yoga. Yeah, okay, pretty much.
Not me.
Not you. Most people. Like, maybe it's easier to show those who do not practice. Okay. But obviously, you've all got interest in yoga. Okay, so to start off, we've got just over an hour, which does not do justice to the dense and sometimes difficult text that is Patanjali. But I hope in this class to at least sketch something of the ideas, the main ideas, and the structure and the contents of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. Just to kick off, who is Patanjali? Where is it located in history? Well, I suppose we start off on a difficult place in the first place. It could range from anything from 2 BC to 3 CE, that kind of era. It seems clear that it's perhaps post-Buddhist and post-Bhagavad Gita. And there are many scholars, particularly in this book, Edwin Bryant and our own Nick Sutton, who very much contend that the Yoga Sutras draws many of its ideas from the Bhagavad Gita. And whether or not that can be conclusively proved, there's no doubt that there's correlation in many of the ideas, particularly in the Bhagavad Gita chapter 6, the chapter on yoga. Now, Nick Sutton will be following this class, and I'm sure he'll say more about those correlations when he sketches the historical overview of the Yoga Sutras. It's a very dense text. It has just under 200 verses, sutras, which, as you know, a sutra, it means a thread. It's sometimes called terse aphoristic, like short, pithy statements, but it's more dense than that. There's only about four verbs used in the entire Yoga Sutras, which makes it open to differing interpretation. It's not so clear-cut at times, and it has been read in many nuanced ways. That said, I think there's a coherency that's throughout whatever the translations. It's about the mind, and predominantly a philosophy of the mind. And I hope those of you who are here looking to see more on asanas and more hatha yoga type practices might be disappointed to find not so much here in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, though there certainly is something there. But predominantly it focuses on the mind. It's a philosophy of the mind. Okay, well, first, just how is it constructed? It's four short books, between about 50 sutras per book. The last book has about 30. The first book is called the Samadhi Pada, the Book of Samadhi. The second book is called the Sadhana Pada, the Book of Sadhana or Practice. The third book is called the Vibhuti Pada, the Book of the Siddhis or Powers. And the fourth book is called the Kaivalya Pad. And those are key words that you could say flag up the main contents, ideas of the text. That final word I use, Kaivalya, is the goal of Yoga's Sutras of Patanjali. Kaivalya comes from the word Kevala to mean singleness, aloneness, so separateness. Some state of separateness is the goal. So what exactly that means, well, hopefully we'll get to that as we go through the main ideas. So the first point is, why did he write the Yoga Sutras? What's the point of doing of these Yoga Sutras? What's his purpose? Well, as I said, it's predominantly addressing a philosophy of the mind. So the text in the first book, the Samadhi Pada, sets out the goals of yoga and what it's all about. And firstly, he introduces us to the workings of the mind. Now, that little exercise I gave you to kick off is just a silly interactive way for you to reflect too, as we go through this, on how the mind works. And perhaps we'll go back to it as we read through the first part of the text. So let's start, get into the handout. Has everybody got a handout, first of all? You have to go, sorry, Sean. The very first verses kick off with the purpose of yoga, and that's where we will start to. What is the raison d'etre of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras? Yes. Oh, you don't have one. A big.
No problem.
Two pages, should be four on either side. Okay, so it opens. Samadhi. What does samadhi mean? Anybody know?
Bliss.
Concentration.
Yes, it's like the highest form of concentration, absorption almost, complete, pure consciousness. You could say that sense, the goal. So it starts out with the goal. The purpose of yoga here is the teaching on yoga. And yoga is the citta vritti nirodha. It is the citta is, it's been translated as thoughts, as mind, but it's really the whole instrument of thought and thinking, the citta, the consciousness, where the whole lot converge is, that's what the citta is. And it's the restriction of the movements, the vrittis, the fluctuations, the movements, the transformations of the mind. That's really what the vrittis are. And the purpose of yoga here is to restrict them. Some say bring them into stillness, because these vrittis, fluctuations, movements of the mind, are constantly in flux. And that's really where we start off, looking and analysing our mind. What is the difficulty? What's the problem? So the first thing, he talks about is, well, what are these vrittis that are constantly in flux? We will move on to that. When this is achieved, the vrittis are stilled, the witness, the purusha, the true self, comes to exist in terms of its true identity. So it actually, in one sense, is an awakening or a deeper knowledge, a viveka, a pure understanding of who the self really is, apart from identifying with the mind, these vrittis. Otherwise, the witness assumes the identity dictated by the movements of the mind. So if you don't do this, what will happen is there will be a misidentification of the self with the head. That's the problem. So, what are the vrittis? This is the first thing. It's like, what are these fluctuations, movements that constantly come? Well, it divides it into five, and we won't get too tied down in the technical details here. The first is the way the mind gathers right understanding. So the mind reaches out, and it's like, I gave you a piece of paper here, and you say, oh, it's a piece of paper, she's given me crayons. So through observation, you look at evidence-based understanding, you try to work out what's what. So there's the mind, the mechanisms, the modes of operation of the mind, or seeking for right understanding, or it can be misjudgment. They actually makes mistakes. It can have false judgment. It's not based on evidence at all. It's based on just words or it's not founded in evidence. So there's those two types of the mind working, trying to gain understanding. And then there's Vikalpa, which can be understood as between that. It's based just on words, speculation, could be imagination. It's not grounded in evidence. So there's three. So there's right understanding, wrong understanding, and somewhere in between, either imaginative uncertainty in the middle of it. Then there's two others, the way the mind works. And one is a little difficult to understand. It's nidra, sleep, which is not clear, because often, and it's a deep kind of sleep, the sleep where there's no object in the mind. So you have very deep sleep. So in other understandings, philosophical traditions, namely the Vedanta, school of Vedanta, it seems that deep sleep is, there's nothing, it's not dreams.
Subconsciousness.
Yeah, exactly. It's something like that. It's saying that there's still something. That when the commentators and the Yoga Sutras have their own commentators, the Vyas, Dhyana Bhikshu, there's many different commentators. They say that it might be when you wake up and you've had a very deep sleep, you still know what kind of a rest you've had. You still know, oh, I've had a very restless night, or I've had a very deep sleep, or that was a very good sleep, or you still have a sense of how that sleep was. So there's still something there in the mind. And the fifth one then is, we're talking about the movements, what are the mechanisms, the modes of operation of the mind? The smriti, recollection, memory. Your mind reaches back and recalls an image, an idea, a thought, a scent, a smell, a sound, something it reaches back and it brings it forward. So these are, you could say, the five ways in which the vrittis, the mind, is constantly operating. Now, when you had that exercise with the piece of paper, any of those come to play?
Yes, the smriti comes to play. You listen to a chanting, which is a Vedic chanting, a chanting, and then it takes you to the what happened at that time.
Okay, or the smriti when you heard that, and this exercise might have brought you back to a time when you were in India and you had some experience with chanting or meditated, a very positive or a negative one. And that's the point, actually, here. These five vrittis can actually influence you, afflict you, or not afflict you. They can be both ways. They can have two different kinds of results. Anybody else want to say anything that struck you in that exercise and just now what we've spoken about vrittis, the little we've said about it?
So for me it wasn't recollection, it was more of purpose.
Uh-huh.
So I don't know what vritti that would be.
Well, even the question, what's this about?
Yeah.
You know, why are we doing this? What's the purpose between it? So now, pratyaksha, one of the things, you're seeing the piece of paper, you're understanding that, what is the purpose of this? And linking it in your mind to, now we're saying it's to do with the vrittis. There's a little bit of a coherent connection there. So it's the mind using these mechanisms. Anybody else got a thought on vrittis just so far? But I want you to say they're not things in themselves. They're just modes of operation, mechanisms. The mind is, this is how the mind works. Yeah. Okay. So that's, first of all, Patanjali wants us to just understand the self, first of all. So this is how the mind is operating. And he's saying that to Nirodha, chitta vritti Nirodha. He wants to restrict still these vrittis. Why? Because otherwise, number four, the witness, the self, the Purusha, identifies with takes on what the mind is telling you. It identifies with that. Now, everybody knows this. It's like, have anybody ever told, oh, I'm useless, I'm no good, I'm an idiot, I'm a fool, or alternatively, I'm fat, you know, my bum looks big in this. There's unlimited things your mind, tell me one thing your mind tells you that you believe. Go on, let's start with the negative ones. Somebody, you don't have to prepare your soul here, we're not actually in a counselling session, but at the same time, when you feel safe about, like, what is the mind, you know, telling us, drawing up from our memories? It's like, perhaps something negative come up, oh, it's the drawing exercise, oh, that reminds me when I was at school, I hated drawing because the teacher punished me because I was no good at art. So that, you know, drawing, the mind going back and drawing from the memory, and it's telling us something. So it's this process of misidentifying who we are with the mind. And that's what Patanjali is so brilliant and so useful and so contemporary, actually, in his application. So while it is dense, it has enormous application. I hope you'll see that. Today, the whole school of mindfulness and the self-help and mind, body and spirit section of bookshops and libraries could be, you know, circled around Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, and I hope you'll see that too. All right, so that's the first thing, is the vrittis. Why do yoga? Well, you do yoga, one, because of vritti. Why yoga? What's the purpose of it? Okay. So, how do you stop it? Let's just be Nirodha, the second bit, 12 there, the restriction of these movements of the mind is achieved through abhyasa and vairagya. Now, these two words are abhyasa and vairagya. It basically means practice and renunciation. And has anybody heard these words before? Anyone familiar with the Bhagavad Gita? In chapter 6, this. And here's where the correlations with Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and the Gitas comes on. Here, Krishna is speaking about the philosophy of yoga. And what does Arjuna say? He says, oh, but Krishna, it seems to me that the practice of yoga is too hard. You know, the mind is restless, turbulent and unsteady. And it's more difficult to control than the wind, vayur. It's chanchala, it's constantly moving. So when Arjuna says, hey, this mind stuff sounds too difficult, what is the response? Krishna says, it is possible by abhyasena vairagyena. It's possible, but almost identical to this. So straight off on the first thing, you've got some help here, abhyasa and vairagya. So then he potentially begins to explain the nature of this kind of abhyasa and the nature of this kind of vairagya, this renunciation. So what does the practice look like? Is it like a day school here in Oxford? Actually, no. It must be ongoing. It must be interrupted, and it must become a practice that's of length and duration and steady. So not something just, okay, I'm going to do a bit of, you know, sporadic, shall we say. It must create its imprint. And the vairagya, the renunciation, what can that be? Well, it's basically self-mastery on what you hear and what you see. You actually learn by a cognitive effort to restrain. That's one way. Or it could be by understanding and a realization of the true self, having a deep realization of who you really are. And by that, your senses are restricted. So this idea of realizing the true self, going beyond what the mind is telling you, beyond the mechanisms, the vrittis of the mind, and how can we know what the self is, potentially moves on then into degrees of deepening this realization. And he has, well, I won't go into the details of that, of a knowledge and degrees of deepening that knowledge and how it can be achieved. And then, after it's basically a deep realization of the self can be achieved by practice. And after he outlines the ways this can be practiced, he also gives an alternative. So it can be done by application of the cognitive process, by determination, by application of your, you know, it can be by the exercise of the mind. And this can lead to great bliss, but it means effort. Or it can actually be done by faith, and by remembrance, it can be done through samadhi, more an experiential type of it. So it can be a cognitive process and applying yourself an effort, or it can be more of an experience through faith, through memory, through revelation, through virya, or he says, after he describes these deepening types of realization, he said, or it can be by Ishvara Pranidhana. It can be by devotion to the Ishvara, giving another application. And here I chose to put this, a few verses of this alternative way of deepening the realization of who is the self. It doesn't just have to be by cognitive processes. It can, or by yogic practices. It can be achieved by devoting oneself to the Lord. So I'm now in the third section here. Perhaps maybe just we can read it. Would you like to, Giri, just read a verse as we go around? This is Devotion to Ishvara on page one.
Yeah. This is one. Mm-hmm. Devotion to Ishvara, or it may be achieved by devoting oneself to the Lord. It's one and then go to the next person.
The next person, the next one.
Ishvara, the deity or Lord, is a special Purusha, free from the influence of affliction, action, the ripening of accumulated karma, or latent impressions.
For Ishvara, the seed of omniscience has grown to a state that cannot be surpassed.
He was also the guru of the ancient teachers, for he is unrestricted by time.
His sound form is Pranava Omkara. The quiet repetition, japa, of that sound makes its object become manifest.
Okay. Here. Well, the question is, who is the Ishvara? And that has been read differently. Is there Ishvara, the perfected self within? Is the Ishvara a deity in the sense that we see in the Bhagavad Gita? Well, one thing is for sure, it appears this term Ishvara, it can be read in different ways, and it's certainly not as developed an idea of Ishvara or devotion as we find, for example, in the Bhagavad Gita, where you get this whole idea of by devotion or dedication to the deity Krishna. You have this whole other method of yoga of grace, and he will moksha you from the ocean of nescience, that you will have the ideas of salvation. So this is not present in Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. At the same time, we do find this here. So we say, well, who is the Ishvara here? What can we be said about him? It says that the Purusha is a Vishesha Ishvara. It's a very special kind, a very particular kind of Ishvara. And in what sense? He's free from the afflictions. And we'll see this term later. He's kleshas. He doesn't have any coverings, you could say. The ripening of accumulated karma or samskaras. He doesn't have any of the things that we are struggling with that cause us to misidentify our true natures. So that's it. He has some special position. We know that about it from here. From 25, the Ishvara, the seed of omniscience, has grown to a state that cannot be surpassed. Okay, so it's a sarva gyatva bijam. So basically, his knowledge is beyond all. 26 is interesting. He was the guru of the ancient teachers, for he is unrestricted by time. So we get another little indication here that time is not an inhibitor of this special Ishvara. And again, this is reminiscent of the Bhagavad Gita. For those of you who are familiar with chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4 of the Bhagavad Gita starts out, I proclaimed this imperishable yoga to Vishva, the sun god, basically. And then he goes on to say, it was received in succession. He taught it to the royal seers, Evam Parampara Praktam. He was instructing this ancient science of yoga in times past, not just to kings of the past, but also to the sun deity and to Manu. So you get this image, the beginning of chapter 2 of the Gita, which is identical to this, that he is the teacher of this ancient wisdom in times past. So, what else do we know about this Ishvara? His sound form is Pranava Omkar, the sacred syllable Om. We hear this. This is throughout all of the Vedic scriptures, right down in the Vedas, the Upanishads. We have this special quality of the Om sound as being the sacred syllable Om. And here we have it again, but it's identified here with the Ishvara. And 28, the quiet repetition, japa, of that sound makes its object become manifest. So, again, we're beginning here. What are we talking about? We're talking about abhyasas, the practices that can be undertaken to kind of break off that misidentification of the self and find and understand who the self truly is. And that can be deep realization, in nuanced way, very profound, cognitive or experiential, or it can actually be devotion to the Lord. So, when he says, so he outlines the way realization can be obtained, and then at the end of this, he says, this chanting, this repetition of japa, or this process, it's linked to the next section, can cease the obstacles that disturb our practice. So we're into a whole other thing now. So first of all, we've got the mechanisms of the mind, and we've got the way it misidentifies, and he's got the solution to it. It's actually by deep realization, by devotion to the deity. But there's these blockages, aparyayas, which come in, these interruptions to our practice. And what are these interruptions? You don't have them here, but I'll just list them. And just think, any of you have ever tried to study, any of you have ever tried to meditate, any of you have ever tried to fulfill an obligation or a determination to exercise, to diet, to do something you've resolved to improve your lives. Okay, these are the obstacles. Have you all got something in mind? Can you think of something you'd really like to do? Okay, just share one with me. Anybody got something, some resolution that you fail to do?
Like to cycle and keep getting a flat tire.
Don't think Patanjali deals with flat tires, but actually in one sense, yes, he does. Anybody else got something you'd like to do and you find it difficult?
Learning Sanskrit.
Okay, learning Sanskrit. Eating less sugar.
Eating more sugar.
Eating more sugar. Yeah. Everyone's got the doing more study, exercising rigorously every day. Maybe some of you have mastered that, but there's things you promise yourself you're going to do to improve and you don't do it. So here are the interruptions or the obstacles to that. See if you can recognize them. One of them is disease. When you're ill, disease interrupts it. Laziness, sloth, doubt. You're not sure, maybe it's not so good to give up sugar after all. Maybe this exercise is all too overrated. Doubt. Negligence. Well, I just can't be bothered. Carelessness. You do it in a year. Negligence. You're not determined. Indolence.
Laziness.
Indolence is, yeah, laziness again. Another. Indulgence. You overindulge. It's, you don't restrain enough. Misapprehension or confused understanding, you could say. And failure to keep your understanding firmly grounded, like failure to be steady, you could say. A lack of consistency in your practice. So that's what Patanjali outlines as the interruptions, the obstacles to our practice, our abhyasa, why it is we don't stick with our practice and vairagya and our do's and our don'ts. You could say the abhyasa is to actively do something, and your vairagya is to actually restrain something, to withdraw from all the things that tempt you and titillate your senses, some sense of controlling or restraining. So they are the obstacles. And these obstacles, they actually scatter the mind. They're chitta vikshepa. It's like the mind is, you could say, scattered by these interruptions. It's a beautiful understanding. Chitta vikshepa. So fragmented, scattered. So you're in this state because if you want to go deeper, get past what all the mind is telling you of who you are, resolve to go to a deeper understanding of yourself, you start these practices, devotion, yoga, meditation, so it could be so many things, and all of these obstacles come up. So, what to do? It gets worse. And he says, these distractions are accompanied by distress, dukkha, dormanasa, it's dejection of the mind, you're feeling really dejected and down. Even sometimes you can have trembling of the body. You're actually, physical symptoms are manifesting from the mental state you're in. And furtherward, inward and outward breathing. So you can it affects your breathing. So here, in the very first book of the, we see what Patanjali is telling us is that what goes on inside affects how you act outside. So the world of the mind and this philosophy of the mind is vital to bringing about transformation of your understanding of who you actually are and thereby your how you can actually, your physical action in the world. So, yeah, so that's the downside. These are the obstructions. So what I included in your handout, I thought a more positive thing, is how to overcome those vikshepas, those scatterings, and coming to a state of citta prasad, which is basically where the citta again being the collective mind, thought, thinking that goes on, your consciousness, how it can become serene and tranquil again. How can we re-establish citta prasad? And why I like to put this in here, because sometimes I think yoga gets misunderstood to be something you have to do in a yoga studio with a mat and your leotards, and you need to go to in a group, and you do it on Mondays and Saturday mornings, and it's over there, and then you go back on with your life. But what Patanjali is saying, that yoga is, it's a way of life. It's actually what you do in the nitty-gritty of every day. And that's why I included this, because having spoken about those obstructions or obstacles, you could say, interruptions to our great resolve, how can we practically address these? And it's very practical. So what I'm going to do is just for you to read through these. And this I want you to do in together. Just read through them with the person beside you. Can you think of any example in your life that connects with this? There are now, it's from 33 to 40. Okay? Just go through them together. Read through them first yourselves. And then sit with the person beside you and say, can any one of these, has this actually struck you as something you've done in your experience? So read them quietly together. Put on a little bit of... Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon. You don't have a handout. Thank you. Anybody else? Has everybody got handouts?
No, I'm
going to look up. Are you in
class?
Why do you have that?
Okay. Excuse me. May I ask, did
yes.
potentially
yes.
call the Pada somebody, or is this an editor's later edition?
That's a good question. I don't know. I think was that an editor of the commentators later? That I don't know.
It really depends on who you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, exactly.
Because Philip Maas,
yeah.
Well, he would say that they're not even two different works, right? And
yeah,
that the enumeration of the sutras are much later.
And that it's Vyasa's commentary we're getting all that, yeah.
Exactly, and that it's one consistent work, actually. And he would say that all this has gone later.
Yeah.
That's from colophons of manuscript, but we know
yeah,
basically
yeah, you see
so
both
little.
Things.
So.
But in any case, whether or not that is the case, you do see that they are the key ideas that are treated in each section. That's for sure.
Okay.
The
more I've looked into it and gone over it, I sense the first part is one, and I sense a kind of trilogy of the three. The three sit and overlap more. It looks as if the first is standalone.
Well, you're right about the standard, because in one sense it would be incorrect to say that it was just one subject per each. There is overlap, very much so, between all of them. And it seems to me that Patanjali builds on the ideas as he progresses through the padas, very much so. So he sets out the purpose of it and the goals of yoga, but he builds on those purposes. You could ask the question, why do yoga in the first canto? It's the vrittis, you could say, he deals with in the first pada, and then the kleshas in the second, and then some yama in the third, and then the fourth one, kaivalya. But there is overlap because they all build on each other.
Mm-hmm.
So... Okay.
Because if you weren't, you
draw you back together again. And sorry if it's
still.
A little rushed.
Okay.
So, did you manage to read down through them yourselves?
Yes.
Okay. What is your first impression of them?
Sounds very easy.
Exactly. And this is not a cryptic part of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. This actually seems very straightforward, and that's why I included them, because actually sounds very easy. Any other thoughts?
I don't think it
No, it's not easy. It sounds very easy.
Yes.
No, it doesn't sound easy to me.
Yeah. Okay.
I think it varies a lot. The list varies a lot. Because in the first one, I think that's very accessible, the first one.
Well, yes, but
yeah, number 33. Because it gives you something, you know, we can all practice this.
Yes, that's what we were saying.
Yes.
You know?
I think so.
Yeah, that's what we were saying, except for the last one.
Yeah.
The indifference
towards the wicked. Okay, so basically it's saying, in all the people that you meet, here's a way, a disposition to adopt. It's okay, so, you know, friendship, Maitri, towards those who are happy. So be friendly to those who are happy. You can show compassion, karuna, for those who are suffering. Delight towards the righteous and indifference towards the wicked.
That's the difficult one.
Now, that's a difficult one, and you will see why Patanjali is saying this later on, because, and this will be linking to, that actually your mental disposition, how you hold the inside world of yourself, will actually create your behavior. It creates you. So ultimately, you create your character. And your character, your disposition, your mentality will spill over into your action. So by hating, it's like, Shama, you make me sick. You know, you really do. And you only have to see this in people's faces sometimes. Do you ever see people gossiping? Mm-hmm. Watch their faces and say, well, I don't believe what he said. You know, I think he's wrong. You know, he said that to me. And I, you know, and the face, the whole thing changes. It's like this. And we'll develop this a little bit more in chapter 2, the idea of, your mindset has impact on who you are, your consciousness, and that spills over onto your interactions. So this idea of disps for the wicked, okay, and that's a whole subject that the Mahabharata deals with, you know, how do you deal with baddies? And they took, you know, the whole tomes of the Mahabharata to tell you how to do with that. At the same time, Patanjali's point here is that you make yourself. Yes, go on.
This sutra is really about training, like you were saying, about training your own mind.
Mm-hmm.
But the Buddha also, he has an angle on anger, and he says that if you meet an angry person, then you try and find that little speck of goodness in them, and you focus on that, because what you're doing is you're training your own mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard.
Yeah.
And you can see exactly. You can see similarities in the Buddhist traditions as well. Yeah. This idea.
You see similarities in this to most spiritual teachings.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, exactly.
Mixed with quite a contemporary therapeutic psychology.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you find that, because this is what struck me when you, despite the difficulty and despite the nuance and the different ways it can be interpreted, still this big idea of that the inner world, what goes on in here, affects your whole psyche and your body, and actually spills over. You see that also in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. I don't know if any of you are familiar. What happens to Arjuna when what he sees isn't what he doesn't understand, he doesn't want to fight?
He just collapses.
Well, he actually has his body takes trembling.
And
hair
he
stands on end, and he actually, basically, he can't act. He drops his bow. So he has a physical, you could say, breakdown because of what was here. And this is what potentially is getting at, this idea of what happens up on this level. Is there anybody else, some of the other things? Exhaling and retention of breath. There's a whole school there of breathing breath.
Yes.
And how that de-stresses you or can bring about change up here through breath. Anybody practice breathing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even the basic one, drop your shoulders. You know, let the air out. Breathing is the central aspect of life. You know, what separates us from death is one breath. It's life. So
there's also a touch of the sort of very recent positive psychology of remaining free of sorrow and filled with light, you know, practicing gratitude lists.
Absolutely.
And focusing on your strengths rather than your weaknesses.
Nice. Yes. Anything else, like anybody else?
It's about trying to remember your dream.
Oh, interesting. What about that one? Anyone got something on the remembering your dreams? Why would the realization acquired whilst dreaming or in a state of deep sleep?
Except it hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened.
Happened, yeah.
Because that's short, because it's actually the practice is filtered down to a level of the
subconscious.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So it's quite it's integrated with the psyche.
Yeah, exactly. Dreaming, Svapna, it can actually, you know, I don't know, every so often I do have a dream that's like, wow, That was you can get insight or from dreams.
You say Edison used to do that because the subconscious is thinking, mm-hmm. and comes up with answers to solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So he used to carry some balls, ball bearing, uh-huh. fall asleep, and just as he's falling asleep, the ball bearings would drop, so he'd wake up and he'd remember what
mm-hmm.
the answer was to the problem he was thinking. So there is something in our subconscious that gives us the answers.
Well, there's a whole Jungian science about it, whether you agree or disagree with it. The fact is that it's something about the subconscious stuff goes on,
yeah.
and perhaps can bring forward, you know, knowledge or understanding of some form. Do you have something?
But isn't it also that the way you perceive things in your dreams is the same way that you perceive things in reality? And it can make you aware that for your mind, there is no actual difference between what you dream and your so-called reality you're moving through each day.
It could be that. I think the mind sometimes does crazy things and is more subtle in it and kind of messes up reality. But yeah, I mean, the point here is that there can be knowledge. Something can be brought forward from the subconscious. You have something?
Yes. Is it related in some aspect with what we call on this yoga nidra in the tantric tradition?
Of course.
Because there is that relationship, and I can tell from my own experience, that you can bring the consciousness as low, as down as to the level of the deep sleep, and still be aware there,
mm-hmm.
and use the fabric of the dream to build what the practice is meant to be at that level.
Yes.
And also, nowadays the science also back this experience. We see that it was a quite recent book, I don't remember his name, it was from December last year. He just described an experience that people are now able to prove that some people have total control in their dreams. So they gave some activities to be done. So, okay, you can go to the dream, so let's analyze your brain. So what part of your brain is activated when you raise your arm? And, so when you are there, you're going to do this order, and then you're going to analyze your brain, and it met. So they apparently found out that 25% of the people have this ability. The others, I guess, can learn. But maybe perhaps we're talking about the same thing here.
Well, you know what? I'm going to pause you because the fact that you made the connection is all I'm interested here in this part. Because Geeta, you're going to take yoga beyond. You know, yoga has moved on from Patanjali, and it's been fed by streams of tantra and other developments in Hinduism, and to bring it to what it has come today. So I'm delighted that you found that connection, because even though in one sense there's not a whole lot about the asanas here or about tantric practices, you can see the seed of it and how that's carried on and developed and fed by different streams of thinking within Hindu traditions. And you'll be touching on some of these?
I'll be touching about it. It's a question of rupture or continuity,
mm-hmm.
how you read the whole history of yoga.
Great.
Yeah, so I'll be going
Perfect.
To tantric traditions later.
Perfect. And so what you are saying will find resonance with very much with in that sphere as it develops these ideas that are in seed form here. Okay, just moving on then from that. So what I wanted to show this is that it's something that can be applied in all aspects of your life, that there's not just one practice. It's about this mind in all different manners, how your consciousness acts will shape who you are. Now, the goal of all of this is, what's the point of all of this abhyasa, is actually to attain samadhi, or state of absorption, where the vrittis have been stilled, all these things it's telling you, the way the movements of the mind have calmed down, and your misidentification of who you truly are, a spirit, an atman, a purusha, this eternal soul self that is untouched by matter, will be realized. So here, first of all, there's this preliminary stage of samapati, 41. When the movements of the mind are weakened, it becomes like a clear gemstone. I think it's a beautiful image. Assuming the form of the perceiver, the process of perception, and the object of perception. This state of absorption of the mind is called samapati. So just in general, this is a state of realization, where the mind has been still. It's not quite yet at the stage of samadhi. It's a preliminary stage of samadhi. But you get this idea of a clear crystal, and that whatever the light is, the light within of the self and the crystal and the object all take on the shape. There's no interruptions to it. There's a single focus there. And it's a state of absorption where it's not full absorption, but we're almost there. We're not there yet. And again, Patanjali breaks this down into a kind of a seed form. It's not, it's almost there, and how it develops into its full form. Okay, so the second book, so we end there in the first book with this idea of preliminary samadhi. It's pure focus, pure absorption on the self and not disturbed by the mind. The second book, the sadhana pada is about the practice. Now sadhana, the root of that sad means to travel towards something. So it's the going towards the practices again, enumerated. And you could say, why do yoga according to the second book? Well, it's here I have the first opening part of chapter 2 on your notes here. It starts off with another word, kriya yoga, yoga of action, or the yoga, the action performed by yogis. Yoga based on action consists of religious austerity, tapa, recitation of the Vedas, svadhyaya, and worship of the Lord, Ishvara Pranidhana. And the goal of Kriya Yoga is to achieve the state of samadhi and put an end to afflictions. So here we have the same idea. It's like something that you do will help put an end to obstacles, disturbances. But the word here we get is kleshas. It's and I'll put these words at the end. A klesha is the affliction of the mind. So this second book opens with an examination. Well, what are these kleshas? What are the afflictions that disturb the mind? And the first one it starts off with is, you see this in other schools of philosophy in Hinduism or throughout Hinduism, is avidya. Avidya, a form of ignorance. So first of all, the big A, avidya causes the afflictions. And these afflictions are important because he's expanding on the first book by saying how it is we are bound up in suffering, how we're bound up in this world, not understanding who we are, and ultimately suffering. So avidya, if you think about it, first of all, you're listening to the mind is doing its thing, okay? You've got all those obstacles we talked about. It's telling you all kinds of things about who you are and what you're not, what you can do, what you can't do. You're full of that. So this ignorance binds you in asmita, your sense of self. So you think that's what you are. You think, I am my mind, I'm too stupid, or I'm too unintelligent, or I'm too fat, or I can't do it. My body's, you know, not able to do it. So asmita is identifying with the false self, you could say. And from this asmita then, you think this is who you are, you think you're your mind. Out of that is the raga and dvesha. I like, I don't like. I want, I don't want. So you have, basically yes and no of reacting to the world. So everything that comes at you in the world, you go, I want or I don't. And that's basically what we do in life. You chase after stuff or you resist. You desire or you hate. So positive and negative forces, because you're identifying with what the mind is throwing at you. And then the final one, so these are the five kleshas again. It's like they all come from avidya. They're just like permutations from avidya. And the final one is basically fear of death, or you could say clinging to life. I don't want to die. It's clinging to life. So you have this idea. These kleshas are afflictions, are at us, and they are what ultimately cause karma, what the second book tells us. This is, they cause our karma. And how do they cause our karma? Well, it's these afflictions of the mind, these kleshas, create samskaras. Now, what's samskaras? You can think of the word, it's not quite a scar, but it's like a scar. A scar on the mind, samskaras, impressions, latent impressions on the mind. And these impressions build up, and they are the impetus for action. They're the impetus for how you act in the world. So they cause your karma. They impel you to do good acts or bad acts or not to act at all. These kleshas. So you see the sequence of the thought, the avidya, your false sense of understanding who you are. You get these kleshas. It's like, I think I'm myself, I am my mind, and I want this, and I don't want this, I hate you, and I love you. This constant reaching out and withdrawing, or negative and positive forces, judging everything in the world. and fear of death predominate all your actions and cause your karma. And that is what yoga, why study yoga? Because you need to know this. You need to see how this works. Why? Because karma causes suffering. How does karma cause suffering?
Because you're born again.
Yes. That's it. Why? Because what happens, everybody knows the law in the India, the idea of karma, if there's a good apunya or an apunya, a good act or an impious act, that there will be an equal and opposite reaction. But it's more, potentially makes this more developed, because that will bring about a result. So when you do an action, let's take an example, Giri. Right, here we
hit
go.
Me.
Here you go, Giri. Now we have to do that properly. Okay, Giri, I hate you! I hate you! So the first thing is I do an action, it's like, I hate you, Giri! Poof! Mm. So you get a reaction. I've acted in an angry way. So the first thing is the samskar is on my thing. I've created an impression, a latent impression on myself. So that's one internal reaction. And Giri, what do you do back to me? Go on, girl, hit me. She's so nice, she can't do it properly. So then there's a physical, there'll be a response back. So it kind of works in both positive, internal and external ways. So
Newton's law.
Kind of like that. A karma that's positive or a good action will get a good result. And for example, okay, let's try this one. Turn to the person beside you and tell them something you appreciate about them. One appreciation.
I so appreciate that you are of the same mind.
And switch round.
I happen to be interested in handling trauma, and I find it so contemporary. It is absolutely incredible. It's not psychotherapy or psychiatry. It's just a special way of listening, letting another listen and hear themselves out loud. And this is fantastic. This is, I actually, some of the techniques we've got. They're 2,000 years old, and because he's compiled and not authored, he's going on 10,000 years. This is absolutely incredible that me, a Western guy, 21st century, can find what I call a resonance energy. I can see between the lines, I can't read the Sanskrit, but I can sense where, what's moved him in his time, and we're still struggling in the West. We're very cerebral in the West, but he's contemporary. This is magical.
I'm glad. Okay, have you switched that over? The other person, appreciation?
I can just about read Sanskrit, but I don't know.
Have you appreciated each other?
Oh, we do appreciate it.
But have you actually said the specific thing?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Okay, how did that feel?
It makes me feel.
Okay. That's fine. That's all right. It may feel awkward, but the idea here, and perhaps I'm pushing it too much. Again, if you come forward with something positive, an appreciation or a kindness, that also uplifts you. Whereas like with me and Giri, when I came with that anger, that thing, and that actually shrunk me. I am actually brought down by that action. This is what Patanjali is getting at. It's that as you go out, what you do in the world, the way you do it actually shapes your internal reality. And so those kleshas there are what is at the root of this. Because of ignorance, we identify with our ego, our false sense of self. We develop a hankering, we want things in the world, and aversions. And then we find ourselves, I like you, I don't like you, I want this, I don't want that. Well, this is the way it should be, this is the way it shouldn't be. And we just constantly live our lives in these two reactive ways. And attachment to life. I don't want to die. I'm afraid. It's the biggest fear that cripples us. You know, it's very profound. So basically, Patanjali has set out our whole human nature and said, this is what the problems are. Now he develops this and he goes into the explaining exactly why is it you need yoga? Well, you need yoga to kill the kleshas. So why are the kleshas a problem? Because the kleshas cause karma. Why is karma a problem? Because karma causes rebirth. So why is rebirth a problem? Because rebirth, and this is where we get, actually life sucks. Life is dukkha. It's suffering. That's the problem. And you get this, and this is, you could say, many of the Hindu, well, most of the Hindu, perhaps all of the Hindu theologies all are quite depressing, pessimistic. Basically, suffering is the nature of human existence. And even if you do have ups, they're temporary, and you're going to die. So it's all pretty pessimistic. at the same time, and Vivekananda said this, you could say it's also his name, Vivek, because of Vivek or knowledge, it's not all pessimism. There is a solution. And here's where Patanjali is offering you. It's like, yes, the picture of human existence is quite dismal. It's quite pessimistic. There's a lot of suffering in it. But it's not the only reality. And here's the solution. And this is what the Yoga Sutras are about. It's, and Hindu traditions offer an alternative reality. You are not the body. You are not the self. There is something more to human existence. And here's how to get in touch with it. So in this second book, Patanjali is really getting up some speed now. He's mapped out the kleshas, and then he develops it that, you know, it's not just telling you that. He shows you how that works, how it causes rebirth. And after painting the picture of who we are in human existence, then he introduces the Ashtanga Yoga system that we're all familiar with, the eight. So he does the, sort of paints the why. Why is this relevant or useful or needful, the Ashtanga Yoga system? So at the end of the second book, The Eight Limbs of Yoga, which at the end of page 2 you have, when impurities dwindle due to one's practice of the limbs of yoga, the light of true knowledge emerges, bringing with it viveka, discriminative understanding. So again, because the practicing these, what are these limbs of yoga, auxiliaries of yoga, what are they? They are the yama and niyama. They are the asanas. They are the pranayama. They are the pratyahara. They are the dharana, dhyana, and complete. Now, we all know these. This is what we're familiar with. We're on familiar ground here. But Patanjali doesn't say an awful lot about this. You know, it's not very much. Now, he does the final three of dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. He groups together into, and this moves on into the third book, the grouping of these into samyama, which is basically the three together. Because you could, if you look at these, you could divide the first five into practices, the yama and niyamas. You familiar with the yamas and niyamas?
Do's and don'ts.
Exactly. It's basically observances that you must, restraints and observances. So the first, there's five and five. The first restraints are, well, ahimsa. And if you think of this in light of what Patanjali told us about samskaras and impressions on the mind, ahimsa, well, not harming. This is going to create your world. So then after that, the next one is, does anybody know? Satya, truthfulness. This will also come back on you. Asteya, not stealing, not taking what's not yours. Brahmacharya, restraints of sex, well, practices. Just so you could say, yeah, it's kind of putting a limit on that. Brahmacharya, and then the last one, does anybody? And what's that? Aparigraha, you could just say, kind of thing, grabbing. It's like aparigraha is actually coveting, wanting, that's it, wanting too much, greed, you could say.
What do you say about ashteya?
Pardon?
What do you say about ashteya?
Stealing what's not yours. It's like, it's more or less like, they're almost like moral imperatives. And some of these are very similar to the Jain traditions have based, they perhaps come from this influence, because Patanjali is not inventing, this is not new, he's drawing from resources in the traditions already, Jains, Buddhists, and, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, and we don't know what else, but he puts it together, yeah, so it's there. But yes, yeah, so these, it's very important that before you do any asanas, that these moral imperatives, you could say, are observances, ways of conducting yourself in the world. And then the observances, the other five, can anybody remember?
Shoka.
Yes?
Santosha.
Socham, santosha, so that's like cleanliness or purity, and both inward and outward, santosha, peacefulness, what else?
Tapas.
Which is austerity, performing svadhyaya, which is recitation of the Vedas, it can be broadly interpreted perhaps. And then the last one? In that context, it has been taken widely, but if you're looking in Patanjali's time, it's more than likely recitation. And then what's the last one, because they're linked? Ishvara Pranidhana. So the two by recitation of the sacred texts, what's Patanjali's, probably the Vedas, then you get the worship of the Ishtadeva, the Ishvara, your Lord. So yeah, it has been read differently, and will be read differently, but if we're looking at it in the context of Patanjali, it's probably more than likely that. So you get this whole idea of do's and don'ts, you could say, but it's a whole lifestyle. So again, the point is, there are, you know, lifestyle sections in bookshops and libraries all over the world based on this, you know, and it's not unique to the tradition. The formulation is perhaps unique, but yeah, you mentioned it has resonance in other religious traditions. But that's what makes Patanjali so brilliant and so relevant. The resources are there for so many applications. Okay, so just, I wanted to add, you're all familiar with those, the broad base. The main other point is the breathing exercise, the pratyahara, withdrawing of the senses from the objects. This is the preliminaries to the actual meditative part of it. So the asanas, pranayama and pratyahara are just kind of getting yourself set up. And he doesn't say very much about asanas other than have a comfy place and be steady, be situated peacefully. So there's not a whole lot said about more than being comfy. And then it's the dharana, dhyana and samadhi. That becomes a samyama. It's basically concentration, meditation and absorption. Degrees of, you fix the mind, you stick the mind and then you go deeply. So degrees of more pure absorption. So that's really, and he unpacks those a little bit more, but I won't do. But I chose to look at something here, interesting, advice on how to observe the yama and niyamas, which I thought was interesting again for contemporary life. Now, perhaps the translation is a bit clumsy here. When afflicted by ideas contrary to these observances, one should adopt an opposing mode of thought. Now, basically, what's that saying?
Saying if you feel like being cruel to someone, be kind to them.
Yes, but it's actually saying it's kind of yoke the mind or invoke the mind with a contrary thought. It's actually, may I take some water, please?
It's almost like think before you act.
Well, exactly. It's actually exert yourself. There's actually practical things you can do here. And the 34 continues. Such an opposing mode of thought consists of regarding perverse tendencies, such as harming others, as producing unlimited misery and ignorance. This applies to all tendencies, whether they are performed directly, performed through others, or simply approved of, whether they are based on greed, anger, or delusion, or whether they are adopted slightly, moderately, or with intensity. So, yeah, I like another translation is basically negative thoughts. Vitarka is the word here. They are violence. Negative, it's your mode of thinking can cause a reaction. So he's saying they can be triggered by greed, they can be triggered by anger, or they can be triggered by delusion, these kinds of thinking. They can be slight, they can be moderate, or they can be intense. So you can just say something sarcastic and horrible, or you can actually be very forthright, or you can kill somebody. There's degrees of their application. But he's saying that you should cultivate thoughts that actually go against these. So it's a whole mindfulness thing we find here. In this two verses, you have a whole school of mindfulness. You know, see what's happening, see what the effect is, and counter it. And actually, it's almost, if you're simpling, it's kind of being brought down into little perspective. So you have certain kinds of thoughts, ideas, images, behaviors, and it clouds you, it brings you down, it covers you. Like this, and this is your reality. Or you have certain kinds of ideas, thoughts, practices, behaviors that actually open the picture up and actually get you in a deeper, more discriminative understanding, viveka, or a deeper thought, understanding of the self and the world around you and others. That's really what he's saying here. Okay, moving on. So that's the end of the second book, the sadhana, that practice. By practice, you can counteract the effects of the kleshas. You can attain viveka, and he sets it all up that the practice of the Astanga Yoga can actually contribute to this. Book 3 moves on with the second part of he focuses a little bit more on dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. And really, the main theme of book 3, or the third chapter, whichever way you look at, is samyama, is actually this powerful absorption, the degrees of meditation, pure absorption. And he expands on this book on how this affects the impressions on the mind. It is a very interesting thing. It can actually, and this is explained by the word parinama, it can bring about transformations, imprints on the mind, this powerful form of meditation. So why do yoga? Because this is what it does. It brings about transformations on your whole sense of understanding, your whole psyche, your consciousness, your understanding of who you are. And how it does it, so when all the other samskaras are busting up, all those negative imprints from your mind, what your mother told you, what your father told you, all those horrible things people did to you, they're all coming up. How does this work? This dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, this samyama, this meditation, it counteracts those samskaras. And he has a lovely expression. It says like it's a flood of tranquility is released. A flood of tranquility. So it goes against all those samskaras that are constantly shaping our understanding of ourselves and ultimately our karma, our action, and then ultimately our rebirth. So the samyama then is developed, and this is perhaps the least studied of the Yoga Sutras, is the second half of the book is devoted to vibhutis, or special siddhis, powers that accompany the practiced yogi who is adept in samyama. And again, it makes the point of what a powerful process samyama is, this deep viveka, this deep discriminative understanding of the nature of who the self is, how the world works, and all kinds of powers accompany it. You can understand past, present, and future. You can understand the minds of others. You can get so many different powers, and we won't go into those, and they've been read differently too. Partly it's when you understand the nature of how people work, you can read into human nature. And you can read into the nature of the world. But there's also specific things about he can become invisible, perhaps attain flying, get great riches. So many vibhutis accompany or this samyama. When it's applied in different areas, it has a great force. But at the end of chapter 3, Patanjali says, but that's not the goal. Don't get distracted by all these siddhis, these powers. If you do get distracted, you will fail to meet the goal of kaivalya, which is what words moksha or liberation. And kaivalya is actual separation from the coverings, the material nature that's separating the purusha, the self, the soul, from its true its true nature. So the vibhutis, though they're long, it could be just, you know, a warning by Patanjali saying, look, this is going to come up, don't get distracted. You know, people with power, don't get distracted. And this is what happens. You have lots of bogey yogis. You know, this. It's like maybe if you do attain a certain adeptness or facility, ability to practice yoga, then, you know, responsibility or not to get distracted by what comes with it. So Patanjali makes that point, and he ends the... Did I give you the... No, maybe I didn't give you that. Yes, I did. See, at the... Yeah, 50. Renouncing the powers. It's on page 3. The end of chapter 3. The Vibhuti Pad. And it says, and when, as a result of renouncing such powers, the seed of contamination dwindles, one attains kaivalya, separation from matter. So again, even though a third of the third book is given over to all these powers, the point is don't get distracted by them. And then finally, the fourth book, the Kaivalya Pad, Achieving Kaivalya. This book opens up speaking a little bit more about these special powers and siddhis, and it's interesting. He says that you can actually get these siddhis through mantras, through herbs, through tapa, performing austerity, or you can even be born with them. So it's kind of interesting. After it's all being part of samyama and it's all these mystic powers, he said, well, these powers can be gotten by other means. And the next point, he says, is about rebirth. So chapter 4, why do yoga? Because rebirth happens and you want to get out of rebirth. So why do yoga chapter 1? Because of the vrittis misidentify the way the movements of the mind work and they will actually cause you to misunderstand who you are, and you don't. So why do yoga? You could say chapter 2, or the second book, the Sadhana Parat, the kleshas, because these afflictions, what do they do? The kleshas cause karma. Kill the kleshas. Karma, what does karma do? Karma causes chapter 4 says karma causes rebirth. We get into the rebirth. But chapter 3 is the how you get it. Why do yoga? Because you get samyama through yoga, through deep, profound meditation. You develop discrimination, viveka, the knowledge, the most profound understanding, realized on samadhi, you could say, the preliminary to final samadhi, of who you, the self is. And then the final book takes us to Kaivalya. Why do yoga? Because through yoga you can attain Kaivalya. So just a few words of what is Kaivalya here. Through this yoga, this dhyan, this samyama, you can attain Kaivalya. I don't know your name. What was your name?
Dilip.
Dilip, okay. Dilip came and had a question about Kaivalya. It's like sometimes we understand moksha. It's a form of liberation from the binds of this world as a unified oneness, that everything you become, there's an absolute oneness to everything. And we see this in the Advaita Vedanta traditions, Shankaracharya is the famous teacher of this. And not to digress too much, perhaps I should have said that at the beginning, basically in India there are 6 traditional schools of philosophy, or darshans, ways of understanding the world. And you have Nyaya and Visheshika, Yoga and Sankhya, and you have the Mimamsa schools, which is the schools of Vedanta. And not getting too technical, my point here is they have different understandings of what moksha really is. And the Advaitin school, which you were a little confused about, says that actually ultimate liberation is that this world is not real. It's a sense of an ideal state. And when you have realization, you everything becomes one. There's no absolute reality to the nature of the world. But here, Patanjali does say the world is real. It's that Karyavad. It's basically, there's 2 realities. There's the Purusha, the self, the Atma, and there's Prakriti, there's the world of matter. And the 2 have become bound in union. Why? Because of?
Ignorance. Avidya.
Because of avidya. Back down to the vrittis and the kleshas and all those obstacles and God knows what's going on in our lives. We are so shrunken in our perspectives that we do not understand ourselves. That's why we are bound. We identify with Prakriti. We identify with our body. We identify with what our minds tells us. We are a victim of our fortune. You know, what happens to us in life. We are a victim. This happened to me because of this, that. So the whole thing's very small. Whereas Kaivalya means single, Kevala, aloneness, singleness, separation, aloneness, you could say, meaning the 2 finally go apart, Prakriti is taken off, and you are situated in your own pure consciousness, state of absolute reality. Now, Patanjali does not paint a picture of what that looks like. He just says that this is at the end of it. You will have attained separation from the covering, the vrittis, the minds, the gunas, the nature of reality that has shaped your misunderstanding of yourself and caused suffering. Because why? What's suffering caused by? Suffering is caused by all these misunderstandings of who you are. And you're born again, and it goes round and round and round. So the kleshas cause karma, the karma cause rebirth, and then you got samsara, samsara. The whole thing is going round and round. Mm. Yeah. Okay, so the Purusha is never touched by any of this, but you just have to realize it. So that's the final. He ends with that, and I hope that's clarified that it's different from the Shankara's idea of absolute oneness. So just to recap again, why do yoga? We do yoga because in book here, why yoga? Yeah, because of, it stills the mechanisms, the movements, the modes of how the world works, which gives us a false sense of self. It kills the kleshas, the afflictions. Those kleshas which come are born of avidya, ultimately, cause us to identify asmita with ourself, aversion and attachment, both are there, and fear of death. What's the solution? In book 3,
And book two and three, you get Samanya. This is book two and this is book one. But they build on each other. Samanya is the solution. We did the Ashtanga yoga system, the eight auxiliaries of yoga, or the limbs as they're known as, of yoga. But the last three, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi, are the most powerful. And book three is given over to how that samyama is yoga, how it can affect so much transformation that it brings about vibhutis, powers in one's life. But ultimately, the powers are not the goal. The goal is through samyama, we will attain the highest samadhi, which is kaivalya. And that kaivalya is you finally understand who you are. Okay, any questions?
Just a general one. I'll dwell on the previous one because that's a huge topic, but
of course.
Probably more an observation than a question. In your introduction, you said that this work is open to a lot of interpretation, and yet in this talk, it seems to me to be quite prescriptive.
Yes, yeah. It is, because I've got 1 hour.
That's a very good answer.
Yeah, no, seriously. I think the point is, what I wanted to do is sketch something of the overview of Patanjali's big ideas. They're the big ideas. The time, I think, Gita will go on and she will say how the tradition has built on some of those ideas. Because yoga, it's not that some you may say that this is the classical yoga systems and Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, the philosophy of the mind, is real yoga. Not the case. This is actually just, we have found this representation of yoga, and in it we see the seeds which have developed and expanded in the living traditions, the blend, the seamless meld of different influences that has become the yoga that we know today. And so many traditions, you know, have contributed to that. And
Patanjali is a really good point, because everyone has this yoga as union idea, and actually you have the yoga here. It's quite the opposite, actually. Yoga is not union here, it's about separating the Purusha. But those still same ideas have been used in the stories about union that we'll see later when the Vedantins take over the...
That's
a good point. Sankhya. This is rooted in Sankhya tradition, which is basically, it's basically the world is real. There are two realities, Purusha and Prakriti. And when you separate them, the Purusha will be, but there's other Purushas. It's not like there's an absolute oneness that we come across that you were mentioning.
But the intention when he wrote this probably goes to be quite prescriptive, and as time has gone on, people have made interpretations of it.
Well, you could say that. You could say perhaps the sutra form was a way of memorizing. It was condensed because these were memorized. They may have come from a tradition where they were familiar with the ideas. The idea is that the thread would be rememorized and then it would be unpacked in different discourses and discussions. But yes, you could say we've lost the thread of Patanjali's particular unpacking of it. But at the same time, Hinduism has always been, there's always been different ways of reading these things. And there's nuanced understanding. And yet the big ideas remain the same. For example, the vrittis, there's a mechanism of how the mind misidentifies, gives us a misidentification of the self. There are kleshas, there are afflictions that actually cause us to lose our understanding, our perspective. You know, so this is samyama, there's forms of deep absorption which go away from the distractions of the world into a truer understanding of the self. And kaivalya, there's a form of moksha, or liberation from the suffering, that this is, you know, rebirth of klesha, karma, samsara. There's a way out. So it may be pessimistic, but it offers a solution. Any final? Yeah, okay, no final thing. Okay, he's cut me off.